This is the Pastor Podcast with Randy and Andy. Andy Payton is the lead pastor at Methodist Temple United Methodist Church in Evansville, Indiana. Randy Moore is associate pastor at Methodist Temple. Their goal is to see Christ in everything and everyone.
Welcome into the podcast, friends. I am Randy Moore. I'm associate pastor here at Methodist Temple, the United Methodist Church here on the east side of Evansville on Lincoln Avenue, joined as always by the senior pastor, the lead pastor. I hesitate to call you the senior pastor since I'm your senior by age, but you're the senior and the lead.
Well, I'm more comfortable with pastor, maybe.
Yeah, that's Andy Payton. He is he's one of our pastors, and so he's here with us every week, and it's good to sit down and spend this time together. We are in the middle of another sermon series, and this one's interesting because it's so visual, which is a bit of a trick for a podcast, but you are taking a look at the stained glass windows here at Methodist Temple. On one side of the sanctuary are the Beatitudes. On the other side are the parables of Jesus, and we're getting into this, and so we're already up to the third of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. So we jumped right in. Did you have any preliminaries you wanted to go through before we proceed?
No, not really.
Okay.
I'll let you lead the way, Randy.
All right. Well, so we're talking about the Sermon on the Mount. Of course, this comes from the Gospel of Matthew. In Matthew, there are five great speeches, and people who know something about the Old Testament may pick up on the fact that the five would connect immediately in a lot of people's minds to the Torah, the first five books of what we call the Old Testament. And so this one is the first of those fives and probably the most well-known, the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus begins it with these Beatitudes, and there are nine of them. The Beatitudes also appear in Luke in a bit of a different form. There are Beatitudes or blessings, and there are woes. Mm-hmm. And so it's fun. That's not the purpose of what we're doing here or the purpose of your sermon series, but that's an interesting study to compare and contrast those two.
Very different focuses. I mean, I wouldn't say really different. I mean, the gist of what Jesus says is kind of there in both of them in their own way, but you can see the vibe, if you will, of Matthew and the vibe of Luke coming out in the Sermon on the Mount versus in Luke it's called the Sermon on the Plain. And so, yeah. I'm glad you point that out, though. We have two versions of this particular sermon.
Yeah, so again, a little bit of Bible nerdiness here, but the Gospel of Mark, we believe, almost all scholars believe now that Mark came first, and then Matthew and Luke used Mark, but Mark doesn't have Beatitudes. Mm-hmm. And so this comes from another collection, we call that Q, and that's just we don't have that anywhere. It's just that scholars have put it together by the fact that they see what's going on with Matthew and Luke, and they use a lot of the same material in different ways. And so, once again, this is material that you don't find in Mark, but you do find it in two different ways, mm-hmm. in Matthew and in Luke.
It's the same spirit. That's the way I would describe it. It's the same spirit, Mark, Matthew, Luke. It's the same spirit of Christ that they're communicating, but they all have their own way of doing it. John's the same way. It's always the spirit. It's the spirit of Christ that's being communicated through the gospel. And the details are a little bit different in all of them, but the overall point is still the same. And I think that's what people need to remember, because like you said, you can get lost in all the details and the comparisons and the contrast, and we can geek out on the Bible study. Right. And that's fun to do, really, but don't forget the end game. The finish line is the Christ-like spirit and the Christ-like way.
Well, let me read this, the Beatitudes, in their entirety. I don't think we've done this yet. It doesn't take long. It's 12 verses. Actually, you could really see it in 10 verses, because those 10 verses are bracketed by the statement, the kingdom of heaven, and then it looks like 10 and 11 are, I'm sorry, 11 and 12 are added on there. So here we go. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." This is this week then. "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you and falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. All right. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And you had such an interesting take on the way that you built this out. And you asked the question, what is your cathedral? And you began by describing the fact that these cathedrals that were built in the Middle Ages were not like building a church today, that you might take 3 or 4 years to build one or take a year or so to build a house. These took 100 to 150 years to build, meaning that the people who started on it never saw the finish.
Right. Yeah. So if you're an architect and you're asked to draw up the design of a cathedral, you knew that you weren't going to be the final architect of that cathedral because it took so long. Or if you're a builder, you knew you were building for someone else to complete the project for you. And it's a helpful way to think about just long, I call it like long-term thinking. What are we doing? How are we living our lives now that could impact people on down the road for generations to come? It's cathedral type thinking. I think I got this idea actually from a PBS episode. There's an episode I came across, it stuck. And I got to thinking about how we have a shortage of cathedral type thinking in our world today. We think short term and instant gratification is the way. How does it make me feel right now? These kinds of things. But really, the great type of thinkers and leaders of the world don't think that way. They don't think, well, how is this going to make me happy in the next, 30 minutes? They're thinking about 30 years, even 300 years down the road. How are my decisions going to impact people yet to come and on down the road?
I think about the idea of planting a tree that you'll never see create shade is right along the same lines.
Yeah, and there's something nourishing about that for our soul. Part of what it means to be human is, we can envision down the road, right? It's not like an animal. Animals don't necessarily, they not have the capacity to think into the future and to plan like we do. And so it's kind of like the price we pay for being humans. And so when we're able to think long-term down the road and we're able to see how our actions are impacting long-term down the road, really we're living into that which we've been created to do and be and become. And so it's a part of what it means to be a human being, I guess you could say.
I know you didn't go this way, but I just thought about this as you were speaking and talking about thinking long term. This beatitude says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. You could go off on an environmental thing right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was hard not to.
What's
one of the big cathedrals that we need to be thinking about today? And that is climate change, environmental impact, our inability to make changes that we know we probably should be making right now that could impact generations down the road. And yet we're not doing that. And why? Because we're short-term thinking. We're thinking in that way. And I don't want to just pick on us politically and that kind of thing either. You see this kind of thing in organizations all the time. We make poor decisions because we're trying to ensure our short-term pleasure rather than our long-term purpose. And then what happens over time is as we made these short-term decisions over the years, it impacts who we are as an organization. And then finally people say, well, what happened? Why aren't we successful anymore? Well, you've made a lot of short-term decisions over a long period of time when you should have been thinking about the long game.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's do a bit of review before we dig deeper into Blessed Are the Meek. This is the third week of this sermon series. In the first week, the beatitude was concerning the poor in spirit.
Mm-hmm. And the way I define that is ready to change, right? When you've got to that point, actually the Greek word for poor literally means brought to our knees. There's different types of poverty. In the ancient world, they understood that there's different types of poverty, and the specific type of poverty that is mentioned in the poor in spirit is like a poverty in which we've been, brought to that point where we're like desperate, really. And it's this sort of desperation, and you're ready for something to change, something to become different in our life. And we've all been there, right? Like, we've got to a point where we're like, hey, something's off here and something's going to have to change. I can't really decide what it is, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. And then the second week, blessed are those who mourn. Mm-hmm. They will be comforted.
The two go together, right? If I'm ready for a change and I make that change, then there's going to be some mourning. And that's a part of going through something like a transition or some sort of life type change in how I'm living or what I'm doing. The way I described it in the sermon really is like mourning is the price we pay for making a change in our life or going through a change in our life. And it's part of what it means, again, to be human.
Mm-hmm. New life after that mourning.
Yeah.
Be comforted. That transition.
Yeah. And I'll also say there's almost an infinite number of ways to apply these Beatitudes, right? I mean, the way I'm applying it, the way I'm talking about it, that doesn't necessarily have to be like the only way. In fact, if you read stuff on these Beatitudes, there's all kinds of different interpretations. Like the poor in spirit and the mourning has sometimes been interpreted as sinfulness, right? Like we're horrible, awful sinners, and you know, we trust in God, and that's where we find our comfort, and that's the kingdom of God that we're longing for. But I'm trying to find a way to talk about it in terms of our own modern context. I'll just be fair about that.
Right.
So I'm taking some liberties here, of course. So, yeah.
So again, I'm going to ask you to, you know, create some word pictures here, because in the sermon you described when you got to, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. You described the window in the sanctuary here at Methodist Temple, and you went over what's on the bottom, what's on the middle, and what's on the top of that window.
Yeah, all these windows preach their own sermons. If you understand them, you take the time to reflect on them. And so the meek definitely are blessed are the meek. The window itself is its own sermon. And at the bottom of the window, I never really noticed this before, Randy. I've been here, I guess this is my 11th year now almost, and I've never stopped and thought about it, but at the bottom of the blessed are the meek window is a picture of a yoke like you would put on an oxen. You know, in the olden days, whenever the farmer had to use an oxen, they would put a yoke on the oxen. They would pull the blade and the spade and till the soil, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's a yoke, and there's also a rudder to a ship. And as I looked at the window, I was like, whoa, what's that mean? You know, and they're images of restraint, discipline, self-control, and they're really images of what it means to be meek, biblically speaking. That's what they are. Mm-hmm. And so at the very bottom of the window, we have a pictorial definition of meekness. As you move up the window, there's a picture of a globe, of the earth. And of course, that goes to the Beatitude, blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the earth. And then at the very top, there's a picture of the meek receiving their heavenly reward from Christ. And then, of course, as I thought about it, looked at it, occurred to me, like, so what's this have to do with me? What does this have to do with us today? How do we live into meekness today? And the way that I define meekness they are the cathedral builders. They're those that are on the right adventure. They think long-term. And I know that's a little bit different way of thinking about meekness, right? I mean, when we think of meekness today, it's like a form of weakness. Someone who's meek and humble in the sense that they allow people to walk all over them, and there's kind of like a spineless existence. But no, if you really look at the Bible, particularly some of the major figures in the Bible, that's not the case. And I use Moses as an example. Moses, of course, is the great leader of Israel, leads them out of Egypt into the wilderness for 40 years towards the promised land. And there's actually a verse I found in Numbers. I didn't use it in my sermon, but there's a verse in Numbers where it says he was like, Moses is meek beyond all people, you know. And there's this, and so he's our picture of meekness, right? He's not spineless.
Right.
He's not a pushover. No. What makes him meek? He was dedicated to the right mission. For 40 years, he led the people of Israel through the wilderness, and he had one goal in mind, and that was to get them to the promised land. And the funny thing about Moses is he never got there, and yet he lived for that promised land for people. That's all swirling around. When Jesus says, blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the earth. That whole story of the Israelites inheriting the land, getting to the promised land. And I'm sure the hearers of the first people to hear this beatitude would have thought that. And so what's the promised land that Jesus is describing then becomes a question. And that's the kingdom of God. Envisioning this world as if God were king, living our lives accordingly. It's this world if It's what this word would be if we all actually practice love. And so that's kind of our cathedral that we're working towards as we think about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. And then the question becomes, so what does that look like for us? How do we actually live into a cathedral for us? And so, I don't know, it's kind of practical, I guess, to think of it this way in the long term.
Yeah. So you asked that question, and that was the question that came as a kind of a refrain in the sermon. What is your cathedral? What is your long-term mission? What is it that you're doing that will outlive you? And then you said that deep within us, there's this longing to go on an adventure, and that you call this the hero's journey. Mm.
And I mean, I can just speak for myself here. I long for it. I'm sure you long for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even as we're thinking about this conversation, I mean, there is deep within us this calling in which we're like, well, I think there needs to be more, right? I mean, I think my life is meant for more. And the answer, of course, as you look to the Bible and other stories, is yes, we are called to go on the hero's journey, is how one person describes it. And I take that from a professor, actually. His name is Joseph Campbell, and his work was used to create the Star Wars series and the story of Luke Skywalker. And what Campbell did was he went through all the different ancient mythologies and all the ancient stories of different, you know, big type figures like Moses and Jesus. And then there's also the stories we tell ourselves even today, like superhero type stories like Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, or there's all these Marvel movies. And what Campbell began to notice, though, was that there's a pattern within all these stories of what he describes as a hero's journey. And I guess he came up with like 17 steps for what the hero's journey really is. But I found one author that like summarized it in 5. And so I decided to go that route. It's better for preaching to go with 5 points and not 17 points.
So, right.
But I think within this hero's journey, we find what it means to listen to our calling for that cathedral type of thing. And so Campbell said that every journey really begins with the ordinary, and then there's the call, then there's the threshold, then there's, I love this word, there's the slogging along, and then the hero always returns back home. And so let me just go through that real quick, what he means. Use Luke Skywalker here, for example. In the first Star Wars, well, actually, I guess it's technically, if you're a Star Wars person, the fourth Star Wars,
okay.
You know. But Luke Skywalker's story begins with him on Uncle Owen's farm. And he's bored out of his mind. It's very ordinary. And so in the midst of that ordinary, then there's a call. And Luke's life is disturbed by a message he gets from a droid. And the message is basically, come help us, come help us. And then Luke heeds the call, and he has to go third step. He has to go beyond the threshold. What that threshold is he has to go to a place. If he listens to this call, it's going to take him to a place he's never gone before. He's going to have to leave the farm. And so Luke, of course, decides to go on this journey. He leaves the farm and he goes on this mission, and he has to slog along for a while. And he has to face challenge after challenge in order to save the universe. You know, he's going to meet challenge after challenge. And finally, as a result of this journey Luke goes on, he becomes different. And even to the point where when he returns back home eventually, he no longer fits. And that's any person's story who has heeded the call within, right? Here we are living our ordinary lives. If we're honest with ourselves, we're bored out of our mind. In the midst of that, we find a longing for more. And we find this tension where something needs to change. And Luke's call came from the outside, but I would say a lot of times the call, I feel like, comes from the inside. It's a lot of times this unsettledness. Something's off here. It could be a lot of different things. Like a person could give up a certain habit in their life. That's the call. It could be a longing to move somewhere else. That could be the call. It could be a change of career. That could be the call. It could be that you feel a longing to serve a particular group of people in a particular way. That could be a call. But there's always this longing for more. And a lot of times what happens is we fail at the call. We dismiss it. We don't listen. And so we never get to step 3. We just kind of revert back to the ordinary. But if we listen to it, what happens with these callings is, we listen to one of these callings, what it does is it takes us to a new place, a place of uncertainty, unknown, in which we've never been here before. And we slog along for a while, and we stretch ourselves, and we meet challenges. And the way that we know we've been on the journey is when we circle back and we go back home. That place that was once ordinary to us and familiar to us, if we've really gone on the journey and grown, we have outgrown that place when we get back home. And funny thing is, with like Jesus' story, for example, we see this happening, right? His calling, I feel like, comes from a little bit from John the Baptist, and then it goes where he goes into the wilderness, and then he begins to preach the kingdom of God after John gets arrested. Jesus takes on that mission himself. And there's a point in the Gospels, though, where his family says, he's out of his mind.
Right.
He doesn't fit here anymore. Mm-hmm. And so if any person has ever actually listened to that spiritual call within their lives, they know what this is like. They go back home and people are like, well, who are you? What happened to you?
Couldn't perform any miracles there except
they won't listen.
Healed a few sick people.
Yeah, a few sick people. They don't believe in him, right? Yeah. And so, but I mean, deep within us all, there's this longing to risk ourselves in a meaningful way.
Yeah. We're familiar with the language of the call as pastors, right? I mean, yeah. When did you get your call? And when you go through the system of becoming a pastor, those who are guiding you and examining you, they want to know that about your call and that it's legitimate. But everyone is called. Not everyone is called to ministry like we were called to ministry.
Ordination or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But everyone is called. And I think that we make a mistake if we say that only certain people are called. Everybody has that yearning. Does it get buried? Yeah. And missed? It does. But I think
we play it safe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We play it safe. And so the idea of the hero's journey is so helpful to me because it's universal, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. We've all had this in our lives, and we've all dismissed those voices in our lives. But if we're really honest, it's when we risk ourselves for the long-term well-being of others, these are the things that we're most proud of. Mm-hmm. You know, my kids, my marriage to Leslie, fighting for inclusion in the life of the church, building a congregation where kids are welcome, all these things, they were tough. It's not always easy. I mean, it's not easy being a parent. It's not, it has not been easy to be a United Methodist pastor lately. But it's worth it, right? Like when you risk yourself in that way. In fact, that's maybe one of the most helpful definitions of love I've come across lately. We all talk about, we as Christians, they'll know us by our love. And now the catch with that is, not everyone defines love in the same way. Here's how I would define love. Love is living for the long-term well-being and happiness of God and others. Mm-hmm. That's love that we're called to. Let me say it again. Love is living for the long-term well-being and happiness of God and others. And so when we're thinking about what our cathedral is, that's the way to start thinking is like, how can I live for the long-term happiness of God and others? Where did I find that yearning in me to live into that and to do that?
And sometimes it's useful to use other words to get that point across other than love. I was just at a wedding, and the pastor who performed the wedding said, I want to give you two, three words. You think I'm going to start with the word love, but I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with the word sacrifice. And then he built on that we really have lost the definition of love.
Yeah, love is a kind of a soft word in our culture today, a warm and fluffy word.
Yeah.
And that's not the cathedral building type of love. That's not the sacrificial type of love. That's not the kind of love that really in the long term nourishes our souls either. Certainly is not what meekness is. Go back to the Beatitude. What is meekness? Well, they're the ones that's going to inherit the earth. They're the ones, to use another phrase, they're going to inherit the spiritual reward. And what is the spiritual reward for meekness? And what is that? It's that I've lived my life in such a way that, I mean, I've heeded the call, right? I mean, I've said yes to this. I've risked myself, sacrificed myself for this. And that's really what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. It's like, I'm going to sacrifice myself for the right adventure. Here we go. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how it's going to work out, but I know it's going to be worth it. And I know deep down we all are called to that in some way.
Sunday afternoon, Lisa and I, my wife and I, were with some of her family and talking about our grandchildren. And Lisa goes, yeah, Pastor Andy said this in church earlier today, and she looked at me, and I go, well, he said a lot of things. And then she went, no, about building a congregation for kids.
Yes. Yeah. So 10 years ago, here's a great example. 10 years ago, we had like two kids in the whole church.
Yeah.
And the nursery was down this long, dark hallway where you couldn't find it, which wasn't altogether inviting for families, right? Today, if you show up to second service, particularly at Methodist Temple, well, 30, 40 kids up there and there's people in the nursery. What happened? Well, we started thinking, you know, down the road, what would it look like for us to build a congregation that was welcoming to kids? Started with moving the nursery, which was a symbolic point, but we did other things too, in terms of became more intentional about the programs that we offered for children and all these kinds of things. And so it didn't come easy though. It was a decade and some people weren't happy with the changes we made. So,
and those kids will be here when we're gone.
Yeah. And they're going to have to make that same choice for themselves. Every generation, I think Richard Rohr said it best. He said, it's the role of each generation to live our lives in such a way that the next generation has hope. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I feel like that's sometimes I'll just pick on the church. That idea has broken down in the life of the church sometimes. You know, we feel like the role of the church is to live for my personal preference and happiness and to tell me the things I want to hear. No, mm-hmm. The role of the church is for the purpose of God. And the role of the church is for that next generation, thinking down the road like Moses did, like Jesus did, and like any other person that's going to be followers of Jesus, is we're thinking long-term down the road.
Yeah, and it fits with going on to perfection. You brought this up, and I hadn't thought about it in that context, but that perfection might not happen in our lifetime either.
Right.
But it's the way, it's the path, the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, Wesley, back to this idea of love, what is it's to be perfect in love. What does it mean to be perfect in love? It's really in this moment, in this context, how can I live for the highest good? And of course, that's a moving target. It's always context to context throughout our lives, things change. And so to be faithful then is like, how can I live for the highest form of love in this moment, in this context? And for me, that's what it really means to be perfect in love. And so one of the things that, to use some modern language, though, one of the things that holds us up from doing this is there's sometimes, I got this language from that, I think it was the same PBS episode, but anyway, there's there's dystopia thinking, there's utopia thinking, and there's protopia thinking. So dystopia is that mindset where everything's wrong, it's useless. You know, the world's just going to pot. Mm-hmm. Utopia thinking is I'm never going to be satisfied unless it's absolutely perfect. And so therefore you're never really satisfied. And it's almost, utopia thinking is its own form of dystopia thinking, right? Because right. You're never satisfied and it's never perfect. And so what protopia thinking though is, it's like, how can I, okay, this is imperfect context, this is imperfect situation. How can I live for the highest good anyway? And I'm going to be actively leaning into and living into this idea of going on to perfect love. Yeah, it's a helpful way to think about things too. Because as my grandpa told me when I started ministry, he pulled me aside and he said, now, Andrew, you have to do something even if you learn it was wrong.
You're right.
And that was such helpful advice. I mean, I hold on to that because in the churches or any committee that you're on, there's always that person in the room that's going to tell you why it's wrong, mm-hmm. why you shouldn't do it. And I can tell you this, if you do nothing at all, you're going to get nothing back in return. But what my grandpa did was give me permission to try, right? We're going to try this. If it doesn't work, we're going to learn something from it. And we're going to keep trying again. Right. And we're going to do it again. And we're going to be a protopia type thinker. We'll be proactive. And so, yeah, there's always a reason not to, but it takes courage to say yes.
Very good. So what is your cathedral? That's the question, the refrain that you ended with. Okay, coming up this week, we are coming up to the fourth beatitude.
Was it hunger and thirsting for righteousness, for they will be filled? Yeah. So admittedly, I haven't had a lot of time to think about it yet. I have been reflecting, though, as much as I can. So the thing I'll say about righteousness, just off the top of my head, is this. Righteousness is not some sort of code that we're trying to attain. Instead, righteousness is a word that we use, biblically speaking, to talk about a relationship that we enter into. It's a relationship with the holy that we enter into. And once you make that distinction, then it really takes on a new life. And so what does it mean to live for righteousness in an ever-changing, evolving world where there's ups and downs and twists and turns? What's that mean? Well, it's not like I'm trying to live up to this code. It's more like, how can I relate to the holy and the sacred now and now? And I'm going to play with that, I think, a little bit this Sunday. I look forward to it. I honestly believe that if we could convince people that, again, that God is with them and God loves them, they will be filled. If you could just, and not as an idea, Randy, mm-hmm. but as a lived, aha type of wondrous experience, if we could convince people, I believe if that became real to the majority of our population today, that God was not just this idea that I believe in, it's the lived experience, I believe much of the division would begin to fall away pretty quickly. I believe we would find productive ways to move forward together as a people very quickly. A lot of this chatter that we find in our society today would begin to quiet down, and we could be more productive as a people if we could see in this way. And I think that's at the heart of what Jesus is trying to get people to do in the Beatitudes. Like, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are they who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those, just real simple, who are open to this, hey, there's more than this. And it's coming, and it's here, and it's now. That kind of thing.
We need to hear the voice from heaven that Jesus heard at his baptism.
Yes.
You are my beloved yes. son so, with whom I am well pleased. Oh, we need to hear.
That's the voice.
Yeah.
Yesterday. how long is our podcast right now?
We got a few minutes.
Okay, good. So yesterday, one of the things I do on the side is I will help UE with their ceremonies. And yesterday was the athletic commencement graduation service. And I have a pretty good streak in terms of I have submitted my script every time, and I've almost never gone by the script every time.
Right.
And so it's kind of become a joke, really. I'll send it to you, but who knows what I'm going to do. So we went through the commencement ceremony, and we got to the end, and I was supposed to give a benediction, and I did. And I explained to the crowd there, I said, so the word benediction actually means good words. That's what it means. It goes back to a couple Latin words. It means good words. And we all need to hear good words. And so I said, hear these good words from Thomas Merton. As you go forward today, become what you already are. You're beloved. Mm-hmm. And I told the graduates, you're beloved by your friends, your family, the university, and above all, God. Become what you are already are. Now, I just said that on a whim. Amen. Sat down. I never had so many people come up to me after a graduation service and say, thank you. I just needed to hear that. I need to hear it. I mean, I'm talking about old folks.
Yeah.
The graduates, everyone. I mean, and you're right. It's a universal thing, right? We need to hear that. Mm-hmm. There's so many other voices out there. And they lead to self-rejection. To hear the voice of the beloved is to hear that I am accepted. I'm appreciated. And God, again, is with me. God loves me. Mm-hmm. That's what it means to be filled.
There you go. That's a good point to end on. All right. Thanks, Pastor Andy. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, friends, for joining us here on the podcast. We appreciate it so much. Hope that you have a great week. See you again next week.
This has been the Pastor Podcast with Randy and Andy. You are welcome to join us at Methodist Temple in person or online. Methodist Temple is at 2109 Lincoln Avenue in Evansville, Indiana. Our traditional Sunday morning worship service is at 8:30 with our contemporary service at 11. Log on to our website at methodisttemple.church. We see Christ in you.